This is podcast number 99 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. Hi, I'm Marlene Peterson, and today's sampler is from the life of William Penn. I am constantly amazed at all that was left out of my history lessons in school. While the name William Penn is familiar, I knew him only as the colonizer of Pennsylvania. The part I didn't learn is that he is a wonderful example of a leader who governed by love and by faith. As Kieran Doherty says in the introduction to his biography of Penn, there are few men and women throughout history who have led their lives based upon the strength of their convictions. William Penn is an extraordinary example of such a person. Early in his life, William had a religious experience which convinced him of two things. First, that there was a God, and second, that God had plans for him. With that firm knowledge in his heart, nothing could detract him from staying the course, whether it meant imprisonment, disinheritance, or ridicule. He fought for increased freedom of thought, and many of the ideas he wrote about, innovative ideas, became the foundation for the documents that preserve freedom and justice and tolerance of differences in the United States today. Today's sample comes from the same book I shared part of Sir Henry Vane's story from, Rebecca McConkie's True Stories of the American Fathers. I think you'll agree that you'll want William Penn to hang around your family for a while, too. The founder of Quakerism was George Fox, son of a poor English weaver, but so good a man that he was called Righteous Christopher. His mother was descended from the stock of martyrs. Little George was first apprenticed to a shoemaker and afterwards to a farmer, and he watched the sheep like King David of old. He liked keeping the sheep. It gave him time to dream, I mean with his eyes open, and think and pray, for he was a praying boy. But the more he wept and prayed and struggled, the more miserable and bewildered he was. He could not understand those strange, mysterious things, life and death, God and his own soul, nor be satisfied exactly as to what his duty was. His parents belonged to the English church, but he found no rest there. He went among the dissenters, the Puritans and Presbyterians, but all to no purpose. They could not show him the path of life. Whole days and nights he spent in agony of prayer, until one day, sitting in deep thought by the winter's fire, he heard a voice in his own soul. It was not audible to the outward ear. It was a still, small voice that only the Spirit's ear could hear. This voice told him that God was not in any church or council or creed or with any priest or bishop or in any temple made with human hands, but he was in every human soul, and if they would but listen, none need go astray, for God would teach them by his Spirit what they must do to be saved. He called it the inner light, which was verily God in the soul. It was also in every man's soul, for God was no respecter of persons. So, of course, all men of every race and name were equal before him. One was not above another, except as there was more faithfulness in walking by the inner light. Now this was thought by many to be a very wicked and shameful doctrine. Where were the kings with their crowns and royal robes? Where were the nobles and mighty men? Where were the priests and bishops of the true church? Were they indeed no better than this poor man, the weaver's son, wasted and worn by his prayers and watchings, and meanly dressed in leathern breeches? And the poor rabble that followed him were only cowherds, shoemakers, and the like. No, verily, answered Fox, no better. So he would call no man king or lord, save only him who was King of Kings and Lord of Lords. The followers of Fox said not to any man but thee and thou, and refused to lift their hats to any, for they said the Lord forbade it. Now, lest you might think that this was a foolish thing for the Quakers to refuse to do, I must explain that it meant more than you might suppose. It was the custom of that day for the highest nobility to keep their hats on in the presence of the king, to denote that they were his equals. Those of lower rank were not permitted to come into the king's presence with their heads covered. To uncover the head always signified inferiority. The Quaker Creed declared all men equal. Therefore, they would not uncover their heads to any man, though they would love and serve all men as brothers and equals. As you may suppose, such a doctrine made the great men and the worldly wise men exceedingly mad. They beat honest George Fox and put him into prison, but he employed the time in praying and communing with God. And after a while, when they released him, he preached only the more powerfully. The people thronged in crowds to hear him, and his prayers were so filled with life and spirit that it seemed as if the very heavens opened to his call. Of course, he made a great many believe as he did, and among those who were converted to the new doctrines was our hero, William Penn. Penn was of noble birth, the son of a brave officer in the English Navy who had a great name at court for his gallant services to his country. William was his only son, and while he was yet at college, only 17 years old, he heard one of these wandering Quaker preachers. His heart was stirred within him. He could never pray by the book afterwards. This was the rule at the college, so they fined him, and he still refused, saying that God had taught him a more excellent way. They expelled him. This was a heavy trial to the young, ambitious student. But his trials were worse when he reached home, for his father was so enraged to think that his only son, the son of a noble house, would disgrace himself by going with such low people as the Quakers, that he whipped him and turned him from his door, thinking by this prompt treatment to bring him to his senses. His mother interceded for him, and his father gave him money and sent him to travel in Europe to divert his mind from his foolishness. Penn was a serious, observing traveler. While in France, he studied the history of the people called Huguenots, and having gathered much wisdom by his travels, he returned to England. He is described at this time as most engaging and pleasing in manner and appearance, skillful in speech and debate, every way calculated to adorn the court of the king, and with every prospect of advancement because of the high favor in which his father was held. But alas, for this father's ambitious plans for his gifted son, Penn found his heart still drawn to that simple people called Quakers, and while listening to one of them explaining the faith that overcometh the world, he embraced the doctrine, received the faith in his own heart, and like Moses of old, refused the treasures of the king's court, choosing rather to suffer affliction with God's people. Thus beautifully he tells us of it. Into that path God, in his everlasting kindness, guided my feet in the flower of my youth when about 22 years of age. He was mocked and scorned by his family and friends, and it was told as a good joke that William Penn had turned Quaker and his father had driven him without a penny from his door. You see what Penn's principles cost him. His was no easy virtue. He could not possibly have borne all this except by that faith that overcomes the world and all that it contains. He was very brave. He went at once to court with his hat on to plead with the king and his ministers to allow the English people freedom of conscience so that they might worship God as they saw best, and prayed him to let the Quakers out of the stocks and prisons where hundreds of them were now confined. They laughed at him and handed him over to my Lord Bishop of London, and he sent him to the Tower, a prison where they put criminals of high rank. King Charles, however, did not like Penn to be shut up in the Tower because of his brave father who had done such service to his country, and he sent another bishop to persuade Penn to give up his strange doctrines and come out and behave like other young English noblemen. Penn sent word back to the king that the Tower was the worst argument in the world, and he continued from his prison to proclaim his principles and send out light and truth from its dark recesses. After weary months, the king granted his release. Just at this time, his father died and left him all his estate. He was of a brave, generous nature, regretted his treatment of his only son, and died in peace with him. Penn made good use of his fortune. He fed many poor children whose parents were in prisons and dungeons all over England for being true to their own consciences. He devoted all his time, talents, and influence to obtain from Parliament some laws to protect the English people in the enjoyment of their religious liberty. But it was in vain. Despairing of any better fate for his poor, persecuted brethren in the land of their birth, he cast his eyes over the waters and longed to build a quiet habitation for them in the wilderness. The good tidings of the prosperity and happiness of the pilgrim settlements in their forest homes had traveled back to England, and Penn resolved now to lead his people thither. You know, I told you that Penn's father had been a great favorite at court with the king and the royal family. He was one of the bravest officers in the British Navy, and for his services to his country during the Dutch War, he received a claim upon his government of £16,000. Well, this King Charles was one of the greatest spendthrifts that ever lived, and of course was always in debt. Penn offered to take the amount of this claim in lands in America. He had much opposition from many lords and bishops who could not endure to think of a Quaker colony being left in peace even 3,000 miles away from them. Yet Penn had a great many influential friends at court, and finally the king, rather than pay the money, granted him a large tract of land on the western bank of the Delaware River and named it Pennsylvania, or Penn's Woods. There were already some Dutch and Swedes living within the limits of this territory, and Penn immediately sent an agent over to tell them that he was coming out to live among them to protect them and to do them good. He also wrote a letter to the Sons of the Forest, the Indians, telling them that they and he had the same Father, even the great God who made heaven and earth and all that it contains, that therefore they and he were brothers, and ought to love one another and live in peace and goodwill. His will was to be law throughout the colony, and he could have done much wrong to the people and made himself rich by oppressing them if he had been a selfish man. But fortunately, he had but one wish, and that was that these people would be virtuous and happy. Then Penn made all his arrangements to lead out his colony to their new home. He left his beautiful and loving wife with his sweet children in England, that the children might be educated, admonishing her to live sparingly till my debts be paid, for he had spent so much money helping the poor people that his own family were poor, and were obliged to live very frugally. All being ready, the Quaker colony embarked for America, and on the 27th of October, 1682, William Penn landed at Newcastle, Delaware. The people crowded to the landing to welcome the Quaker king, for thus he was called, and indeed his power was absolute over the territory he now owned. He spoke kindly to them, exhorted them to industry and sobriety, and promised them his friendly offices to do them all the good in his power. With a few friends, he left Newcastle in an open boat and journeyed up the Delaware in the soft, mellow November days to the beautiful banks fringed with trees on which the city of Philadelphia was soon to be laid out. Here he met the chiefs of the various Indian tribes. They assembled beneath a great elm tree, and Penn told them that the English and the Indians were to obey the same laws. Both were to be equally protected in their pursuits and possessions, and if any difficulty arose, it should be settled by an equal number of English and Indians. "We meet," said he, "on the broad pathway of good faith and good will. No advantage shall be taken on either side, but all shall be openness and love. I will not call you children, for parents sometimes chide their children too severely, nor brothers only, for brothers differ. The friendship between me and you I will not compare to a chain, for that the rains might rust or the falling tree might break. We are the same, as if one man's body were to be divided into two parts. We are all one flesh and blood. This treaty of peace and friendship was made under the open sky by the side of the Delaware, with the sun and the river and the forest for witnesses." Penn came without arms. He declared his purpose to abstain from violence. He had no message but peace, and not a drop of Quaker blood was ever shed by an Indian. Here, on a neck of land between the Schuylkill and the Delaware, William Penn laid, at Philadelphia, the city of refuge, the mansion of freedom, the home of humanity. In after years, Pennsylvania bound the northern and southern colonies in bonds stronger than chains. Philadelphia was the birthplace of American independence and the pledge of union. For several years, Penn remained with his colony, directing and ruling for its best interests, and his heart was gladdened with the sight of its prosperity and happiness. But he longed to sit once more at his own fireside and looked upon the dear home faces he had left. Besides, his colony was so well established and governed by laws so mild and good that the people had nothing to do but to be industrious, virtuous, and happy. Penn thought of the hundreds of English Quakers that still languished in dungeons and prisons. He felt that he must go back to England and do something for them. So he did. He labored day and night and was instrumental in obtaining the release of not less than 1,200 friends. But he pleaded not only for the Quakers, for his sympathies were large enough to take in all mankind, and he, like Sir Harry Vane, claimed liberty of conscience for all men. He continued to watch over his American colony, sending out emigrants and advancing its interests in every way. In extreme old age, he writes to them as a father to his children. "If the people want of me anything that would make them happier, I should readily grant it." He left the people of Pennsylvania free to alter their laws as they should think best, but the form of government devised by Penn's love and wisdom was so nearly perfect that to this day its fundamental principles remain. These are some of the words of his farewell to his people. "My love and my life are to you and with you, and no water can quench it, nor distance bring it to an end. I have been with you, cared over you, and served you with unfeigned love, and you are beloved of me and dear to me beyond utterance. You are come to a quiet land. Liberty and authority are in your hands. Rule for him under whom the princes of this world will one day esteem it an honor to govern in their places. And thou, Philadelphia, the virgin settlement of this province, my soul prays to God for thee, that thou mayest stand in the day of trial, and that thy children may be blessed. Dear friends, my love salutes you all."